Saturday.
What day is it today?
Wednesday.
Exactly.
Welcome to Film Fight Club. I'm Glenn Falconstein from Falcon Screen, and we're joined by Sydney filmmaker Chris Evans.
Hello.
And freelance writer and critic Virat Nehru.
Hello, hello.
Later in the program, we'll be talking all things Bill and Ted Face the Music, which is in cinemas now. A couple of things happening around town. The Queer Screen Film Festival is online going until the 17th. The Gold Coast Film Festival is having screening events this week online. And Static Vision are going into their 26th week of screenings. That's half a year this coming Friday. And the Antenna Documentary Film Festival will have a couple of events in person, also tied in with the Queer Screen Film Festival. And on the 19th, if you're up Blue Mountains Way, the Blue Shorts Film Festival is happening at the absolutely gorgeous Mount Vic Cinema. But for now, the Sydney Underground Film Festival is going online for the first time in its 14-year history. It is in full swing. Chris and I had a lot of fun watching a number of the shorts programs, including Take 48 over the weekend. And we have with us the director of the Sydney Underground Film Festival to talk all things up, Stefan Popescu. Stefan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You're always at the Factory Theatre for the first time. You've gone online. Stuff is accessible around the country and to patrons everywhere. What has it meant for the festival to go online? Can you tell us a little about the process of getting this festival up for the masses and for everyone to see?
Yeah, well, it was interesting because with all the COVID restrictions and the general...
Glenn made it sound so positive. I'm sure it's not ideal for you, huh?
No, we're community-based. Like, as anyone who's been to the festival knows, part of the whole festival is going to the Factory Theatre and, you know, watching a film, then going to have a beer, chatting to the filmmakers, then going to do a workshop, you know, having that choice. It is like a festival, like a music festival or something.
Yeah. The Factory gives it that because you've got that courtyard and all the cinemas are built around it. Everyone meets in the central area. It's great.
An amazing jerk chicken place.
Yeah, the site specificness of it is very important to the festival. And so we were very disappointed when this situation arose. And it was sort of part Factory Theatre, part the unpredictability of what the hell's going on with this COVID. Mm. So we went, well, let's try it online. So, we found a platform to go through. I mean, it is what it is. And there are opportunities. So there is a positive side to it because, you know, for the first time, people in America and Ukraine, and actually we're getting a lot from Ukraine strangely because of the Ukrainian session, are able to see the festival. So there is this opportunity to get us out to the rest of the world, which is fantastic, and get a new audience, which might even linger after this time. Like, you know, we actually said at the beginning, oh, look, if this is successful, because we're doing just shorts as well. I made the decision really early on because usually it's me that chases the feature films and stuff. And we actually tried chasing a feature film or two. And it was like near impossible to cut deals with distributors that like...
You probably need some real weight behind you, like at least MIF size to be able to do that, right? I mean, even Sydney Film Festival, with the exception of a few tiny Please Please Screen Us movies, were only shorts this year.
Exactly. So, but it's also just a legal nightmare because a lot of them already have cut deals with online screening before, because the way the road works or whatever, the pathway works, is that you sell out all your online distribution, you sell out your theatrical, and the last thing that's left is festivals and stuff, which come first. So your film gets into a festival, and it usually depends where you're premiering it to. Like if you're premiering it in your home country, you get leeway, so you can still be called a premiere overseas. And then premieres at a festival, then goes into the cinemas, and then 2 weeks later or so, it's online. And so the deals are already set up. So, you know, you're trying to cut a deal going, can I screen your film online before it goes to Netflix? Like Netflix will never allow it.
It's such a shame that somehow no one's figured out online distribution rights yet, or even just international distribution rights. It's still like this great unknown that everyone's still figuring out, it seems to me.
Because I would feel that given you're a festival, that this online screening would still count as a festival screening, but it's supposedly not, which is kind of still shit.
Well, it's such a gray area that this has really pointed out that gray area. And yes, it would be quantifiable as that unless the online platform wanted to argue differently. So the distributor would have to go back to the online platform, go, hey, Netflix, I know that we're premiering with you, online and our contract solely with you, but hey, can this small festival do a screening before you? it I just saw landmines everywhere and went, man, this will take like lawyers, like a group of lawyers to work this one out. So
they're the worst.
And at a point where you have less money than ever before, probably.
Yes. Yeah. We had a ton of our sort of sponsorship cut and stuff, purely because part of our sponsorship comes from Sydney University. Sydney University had all the COVID problems, and I work for Sydney Uni, and I shouldn't say too much, but I had some research, personal research funding and also curriculum funding and stuff like that, which was substantial, and everything across the board was brought into austerity measures. Now, they didn't officially cut it. They just kind of went, oh, you can only spend it on these things, which are none of anything that's related to what you can do.
Depressing.
So it's going to be interesting times. I'm very intrigued about the economic fallout of this, to see what's going to happen, because right now it's just being bolstered by tons of debt that our children are going to pay.
Or not. I'm not going in a political direction. I reckon a lot of the debt stuff is scaremongering. I think there'll be other fallouts, but I think the whole thing about you're all going to pay the debt, no. I feel like it's debt to ourselves that we're going to decide we don't have to pay back. Because why would we? It's guaranteed based on our success. See where we are progressing as an economy. Provided we get to that point, the debt's guaranteed. I think there's no way anyone can ever pay this off. Yeah. Let's all agree.
Just make more films, just shoot more movies.
Make more stuff, infrastructure, films, whatever. Just make stuff, don't pay the debt. Because if we have to pay the debt, we are screwed forever.
You know what I'd like to see come out of this? I'd like to see more transparency and knowledge about how economic systems work.
Because we've all just done something that's supposedly impossible. A whole bunch of nations are doing that at full speed ahead.
It kind of discloses that the whole thing's a bit of a scam.
Yeah, it totally does. Funny money.
Yeah. It's like, who's this debt to? Where is this debt? What? Federal Reserve? But isn't that us?
I'm
just going to bunker down in the basement of the Factory Theatre and write this out and come out every like few years. Just like, everything sorted? Everything done? No. All right. Back in the hole.
I don't know. I've been wondering a lot about what are the ramifications going to be for film? Like, how do you feel about that, Stefan?
That's really interesting because, like, again, all my film work got cut because it was connected to China. I was getting like
it's gallows humor, everything.
Yeah, that's why. No, it's cool. Like I wasn't
I'm not like haha.
Yeah.
All your funding went through.
So I used to get like a couple of feature writing gigs a year, like maybe one or two. I was averaging at least an ad or two, definitely some consultation stuff on whether it was festivals or whatever. Just nothing, just completely stopped. And I've got a producer friend who specializes in China-Australia film relations, and I speak to him quite often, and he's so optimistic about the future because he's like, yes, we've got to prepare for when things get better. And I'm just like, dude, our last journalist just left China like because they were going to get arrested. I don't think this is getting better anytime soon. I think there will be there's always going to be a film production market or whatever. Like, there's going to be that. Now, what that's going to look like is going to be really interesting.
Yeah.
And which country is going to funnel money into it? That's the question, because it was totally heading towards China sort of dominating the film market, and it's definitely not that now.
Are we going to start seeing films from different jurisdictions? Are they going to be directly influenced by the pandemic, and that we'll see different levels of budgeting? Will we see films really focused on the pandemic and the fallout from
it? I was wondering that too. With what you were saying about China, I mean, I know China, it's interesting because like they don't really have much soft power, do they? I'm stepping outside of the bounds of Film Fight Club and going political, but I feel like a lot of Chinese material is so nationalistic. like mainland Chinese film that it doesn't have much international power. So instead it's like, let's funnel money into international productions as a business venture.
Yeah, they were working, and again, I'm stepping out of politics, but it's interwoven. You can't extrapolate the two. I think a big thing for me is like a big signifier is Operation Red Sea. If anyone's seen that,
I heard about it. I didn't see it. You saw it.
But that was a marker. That was a marker in Chinese film cinema history sort of thing, where it was the first time they really tried this soft power approach, you know, but it's not. It was so heavy-handed. It was nothing to do with soft power whatsoever. But they were trying to emulate that American. So you know, they had economically engaged everyone. There was a lot of political sort of power. And now it's time to convert the minds of people. And this is where they fell short. You know, everything collapsed before they really got in there. Because it could have happened. Hollywood could well have evaded that, you know.
I mean, America's falling. There needs to be a superpower of entertainment, right?
Yeah.
We feel like there needs to be, because there always has been as long as we've had film.
I think there's always going to be entertainment. Entertainment won't go away because entertainment is one of the most powerful ideological and political tools that people have at their fingertips. And it's perfect because it disguises as entertainment, which is meant to be apolitical. And
right.
So if anything, I reckon a lot of film's going to ramp up. And I would suggest, like, I'm predicting that there's going to be, depending where we're heading, but if we're heading towards a hot war or something, I think there's going to be a lot more sort of nostalgic propaganda stuff about Second World War. And I think we're seeing that a little bit in the
news. You're right. Hey, it's starting to come back in. Glenn was talking about how budgets could be affected and stuff. It feels like it's going to take a long time before big budget filmmaking ramps up on any scale. I always make these optimistic predictions about futures for the kind of like grassroots filmmaking stuff that we all love and that your festival's about. And I'm in too cynical a mood to really do that now. But wouldn't it be great if there's the feeling that we need stories and people really stepped it up with underground filmmaking, grassroots efforts?
It's very possible in terms of, because a lot of festivals have gone online. Mm. And I think people got tired of Netflix and stuff like that. I know I am. I can't find anything on there. How did this I don't know if it's billion, but multi-billion dollar company not put out new fucking releases?
they've run out of new content, right? They need to just buy the limited supply of what's left, or they need to condition people to do what they've conditioned people against, which is getting interested in watching older films.
Yeah, exactly. So there is hope that, because people want content, there is hope for indies. I would love for Netflix to go back to its original business model where they were dealing with filmmakers directly.
Right. Yep.
God, that would be my dream. You know that, you know, Chris can go make a film and sell it to Netflix.
I've been hoping it would go in that direction, honestly, for selfish as well as altruistic reasons.
What I'm wondering now, are we going to have more direct access for filmmakers with our festivals going to be a different position, whether it's getting out material or reaching the audience? We've seen Myth have their best year ever and increase their ticket sales last year. Certainly different places are reaching out more folks. Will distributors look for these avenues as they're going beyond, they have their core geographic crowd, but still going beyond that? Is that going to be an avenue that they wanted to, that these the streamers are going to want, will the streamers have to reckon with this?
Yeah, I mean, like, I certainly hope so. And I, you know, hopefully there'll be little companies set up instead of this sort of distributors where they're kind of like agents acting for independence and stuff like that, a little bit like YouTube, how people represent YouTube sort of celebrities and stuff like that.
Yeah, well, we just need people to start caring when they search out the stuff to watch online about stories as opposed to those YouTube celebrity type things. Yeah. Like, I spoke to someone the other day who had a massively cynical take, which I don't agree with, even though I think he has more truth to what he's saying than I'd like to admit, where he basically saw no future really in a big way for any narrative art and was saying film's just going back to 15 seconds long like it was in 1895. I hope not. I feel like, as you say, stories are always going to have a place. They have a nostalgic, potentially nationalistic power, so there's at least some motivation to push storytelling. But I think also, like, people love stories, right?
Well, I think stories, I mean, it's interesting that you're talking about stories, because I think stories are a means of programming. like we program ourselves. We, if you think about little children or whatever, that's how you condition and program children. You tell them stories, and if you want them to be fearful, you put a wolf in there. And you, I think what's happening, I think that stories will never go away. And I mean, it's proof positive. All you got to do is turn the news on. We're living a fucking movie right now.
Oh, you know, yeah, right? We are.
You know what I mean? Like, so you can't say that stories are ever going to go away. The form in which we digest them may well shift. I think that's what's happening. I think we've entered a new era of storytelling. You know, I'm not trying to say that COVID-19, like actually, I think Jamie Leonardo, he called it at our conference, the Inhuman Screens conference. I think he called it COVID-1984. I like that, and I like that not because I don't believe it exists or whatever. It's just the way we're ingesting the stories around it is happening in a very different way. It's actually, we're living this strange apocalyptic movie right now.
It doesn't feel real.
Yeah.
And I think it's kind of what the festival has always been about, looking at respects of society, looking at ways that perspectives that are not mainstream and things that we don't necessarily like or always want to address, but always in a fun and enjoyable way. And I think we watched Take 48 on the weekend, and there's a lot of films that, while we were discussing how many films are going to be reflective of COVID-19, how many are directly going to address what's going on, and some did, but I think some looked at it indirectly. Some looked at it as just the sense of, here's where we are now without needing to bring the pandemic into the narrative. So it was nice to see that mix, at least in that. And there were a lot of films, like much more. There were even more than
last year. There were so many. That was one of the things where I thought felt like the way that nothing's going on except online festivals probably helped in some regard, right? Like it seemed like there were a lot that kind of been just from all from Sydney.
Yeah, our numbers doubled for that. And that was really interesting because it was so last. Unfortunately, we're a little last minute with everything. But that one, we really advertised it very last minute. You know, we didn't totally know what the Sony prize was going to be.
It's a good prize.
Yeah.
When I saw the prize, sorry.
What is it, a Z?
A7S3?
That's it.
Yeah, when I saw that prize, I was like, oh, yeah, I should definitely enter. And then I found out that, and I was also thinking, oh, that would be good. That'll spark my creativity. I've been being lazy with COVID. And then suddenly it's like, oh, it was today. I just did not follow it. I haven't been keeping up with anything, weirdly enough. But apparently lots of people have been.
Keeping up with things.
Yeah, I mean, if 70 shorts were finished for Take 48.
Yeah, that's crazy. But there was a whole bunch that registered and didn't do it because of that. They just kind of lost track of time.
Yeah, I think a lot of us are getting hit with that at the moment.
One day is just sort of melding into another, really.
So speaking of some of these shorts programs that you have in this festival...
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I know WTF is literally self-explanatory in terms of like what the fuck were they thinking. But the Lovesick shorts were kind of there, but I was interested to see what was your programming choices and to picking these ones.
Oh, gee. It was a combo of Nathan and I as well. So Nathan would have to be here to help me out on this. But look, every time we pick the Lovesick ones, we always sort of look for the, you know, try and cherry pick that perversity. what sort of perverted or comical, you know, like...
I love that stuff is the place where you can like outrightly be proud of that and say that like, quite openly. And it's like, a badge of honor, to be honest.
Yeah, totally. I mean, once you call a session love / sick, you know, like, you know, people know what they're in for.
I love the just blunt names of the shorts programs and stuff.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, well, we had to work out ourselves, like, what the hell are we doing? Because we knew our curation, our programming, but we never knew why we were drawn to them. So then we sort of decided to form these little groups, and we just thought there's like-minded film sickos out there, and yeah, sure there is.
That's us. We're right here.
But we love sick. We usually try and look for like the sort of perverse stuff that still got a discursive edge to it. You know, like, I think Jan Soldat's film's in that one, I think.
Yes,
Wanker, yeah. You know, like, that's a really good example. It's a little bit to me, in a weird way, that has a relationship with Impaled, because it was contextualizing this guy just jerking off, you know, and, you know.
Sometimes that flow of the films just present themselves to you, don't they?
Yeah. We just watch it. And we just
goes with
I
that.
Think we definitely channel our inner perverts and, you know, just and still keep a little bit of an academic edge to it in there somewhere.
Speaking of crazy things and perverse things and just having a good time, so we did do the Take 48 session the other night, plus all the others. We had a good 10 p.m. through 2 a.m. Session where we made a film the second time this year with lots of chocolate. So we had all the stars and ate all of them and got a massive sugar high watching all things. Because appropriately, because theme for this year, and I think it's a, I liked last year's theme of The Card, but this I think was a much more conducive theme to a lot of really more creative and amazing films.
Dude, we had the best time. It was just more alcohol than we could possibly get through. I woke up on Glenn's couch at like 4 a.m. and he'd cleaned it all away and I wondered how he could do it.
Mystery I ate it all, Chris. I drank it all and I ate it all.
Mystery Science Theater 3000. No disrespect to the other filmmakers, but you know, 70 short films is a lot.
Yeah.
We finished, we're at the other side.
But yeah.
There were creative ways of using marshmallows. People adopted the theme I found in the film this year more than The Card was integrated in the films last year. Like the marshmallow is much more an integral part of all the narratives.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, no, totally. I was amazed by that. And I apologize that we put 70 back to back or whatever.
Don't.
No,
it was the right call. It made for a great night. It's the stuff you can do online that can't do.
You can pause it if you want
person,
to.
Right?
We just did it all the way through. We didn't pause. We rewound one because we found it quite funny. We missed a few of the things, but we watched them all.
We rewound it when Mystery Science Theater turned into like a panel discussion and the films vanished into the background of drunken haze.
After our one, we had a self-congratulatory pat on the back and
yeah. Yeah.
It's funny because we set up directors for that. So we got Chris and Lauren to do that. I only sort of oversee it. And so I only got to watch, like half of them, and which is good. Like, I don't want to influence anyone on anything.
Yeah.
But I definitely watched the worst ones.
Because
we had to, that was one of the things that I was consulted about. They're like, hey, have a look at these worst 20. What do you reckon? Do we leave them out or put them in? And
so what you're saying is you haven't seen our film.
Did you submit them?
It's got to be one of the better ones.
Did you include the worst 20?
That was the point. That was the point I was going to make, that I made a call going, man, if this is the worst 20, like...
It's pretty good.
Yeah, I can't wait to... So I actually got to sit down myself.
Nice.
Might do that tonight and watch it all the way through. So...
I thought you were going to say we're going to have the bonus, the worst 20.
No, I was just surprised that, because like even the worst, like I had a really good time watching apparently what was considered the worst 20. And that's why I was like, well, this is a friendly competition, you know? Yeah, sure. Like Sony's putting this thing up.
Let's
do our best to include everything and everyone. Like the whole point of a competition like that is to be included.
Especially now, right?
Yeah.
Oh, of course. Absolutely. I'm just so amazed how well people can do in 48 hours. I'm blown away by that. And I also am a bit pissed off because some of my students can't make films that good. And they get 6 months. Right. Like these people get, and sometimes my students that can't do it in 6 months do better in 48 hours. I'm so, what the hell is going on? Is it like where film is better if you don't think about it? Like,
well, it was about the theme. It was just this impetus where we had the sugar, we went out and got it. Pascal's marshmallows did insanely well over the past little bit. Good for them. But
we saw so many Pascal. The whole thing was a Pascal's ad. But no. I think maybe it's just that it's like you've got the incentive and this is fun, as opposed to like, oh, my assignment.
Yeah.
I'm going to make a film. Great. Make a movie in 48 hours. Doesn't matter. It's a friendly competition.
I should do that to my class. I should be like, all right, the one, you got 48 hours to make it short. And the one who does it doesn't have to pay their fees this year.
Yes.
Going off it, like, we watched them all back to back and there were a few where the narrative didn't go in a particular direction, or there were a few that were quite similar in tone and style and what they were going for. And that's to be expected with 70 films about marshmallows, which all include the same line that are all less than 3 minutes long. But there was momentum. I had fun. We sat through, watched all in one sitting. We had a good time. I'm glad they weren't sort of cut. It was nice just to see. I recognized a few people. I worked with one of the actresses in another film, which is in SF3. And just to see, oh, here's kind of the weird things people are doing. Also, a lot of them, by consequence and by design and evidently, had to be done in the confines of their home. So it was just, here's what we have about and here's what we're doing. And I love that perspective.
It was a cool initiative. I'm glad we have it a second year.
Yeah. It's one of the things that has grown and it has potential to grow quite large too.
Well, you know, when we were talking before about the state of things and COVID-19 and where film was going, I was thinking like maybe if COVID-19 mutates into a horrific super virus and we never have film festivals again, or when the nuclear bombs start going off and we all have to go outside and radioactive masks and we're living together in bunkers underground and stuff. Then we can do, yeah.
You've been thinking about this, haven't you, Chris?
Of course, yeah. And that's when, that's when
recording from.
Take 48, it won't be just like 48 hours. It'll be like, you've got 6 months and that's the Sydney Underground Film Festival program. It's like all the films you made for...
Quite possibly. quite possible.
I think Marshmallow's aesthetic of some of my more favorite films will carry on into general society.
Maybe these will become foundational religious texts.
It would definitely give the Underground Film Festival
Hello, other festivals and patrons. Nice of you to join us here. We've been here before.
Underground. Man. Shit's fucked.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're going ahead. Some normalcy, Stefan. You brought some normalcy to my September. Otherwise, it just would have been another, what, is it Monday today? I don't know.
Can I take this completely off topic a little?
Please do.
Please. Well,
you seem to have thought about this a bit, Chris, and you're into stories and stuff. So what's your take on our situation right now? Like, understanding that what you're going to say, it can be completely wildest.
Yeah.
Can I just contextualize this too? I listened to an ABC radio show yesterday about conspiracy theory, and I was kind of a bit pissed off because I love conspiracies, and they were just talking about what demographic responds to conspiracies, and it was in relation to immunizations or whatever.
Yeah.
And so it just really miffed me a little because I'm just like, hang on, this course, you can never, you know, having discussion around shit. Yeah.
Look, I mean, I think there's value in a lot of conspiracy theories, but I understand why ABC took the approach they did, because I think we're reaching a strange point where conspiracies aren't fun anymore, because so many people who you would think know better are buying into some of the dumbest of all time.
I just assumed the 5G stuff was a joke. I couldn't believe the scale of the protests around them. What the hell?
Exactly. The 5G thing was completely stupid.
Can I tell you your friend's theory on the 5G conspiracy?
Yeah.
Because I'm with you. It's like, when I heard it, I'm like, this is fucking retarded. Like, who the hell?
Yeah. It's so stupid.
But I had a friend who had an alternate, which is a theory, which is very plausible, man. He's like, no. So he was saying that the 5G conspiracies that were out there were planted intentionally because a lot of the towers and stuff that were set up, especially like in the UK and the US and stuff, were by Huawei. So for the government to cover up them destroying the towers with thermite and whatever not, that they put out all these crazy conspiracies about COVID and 5G. So then it'll seem like a group of crazy people just took down that tower or burnt down that tower. But when you go to investigate it, it's like obviously being thermited. You know what I mean? Like, who the fuck has access to thermite?
Right.
So it's a very plausible.
That's a cool theory.
I enjoy that storytelling aspect of it. You know,
yeah.
Conspiracies.
Yeah, I just think with what you were saying before, the 5G thing, crazy that that's gotten as big as it has. But yeah, like at SAF, I remember the moon landing conspiracies thing. Like, it's fun, it's interesting, it can be really dumb, like who could believe that? And it can be like genuinely thought-provoking, that kind of like exploration of conspiracy theories. But, you know, I was talking to someone the other day who their relationship recently broke up because their partner went all in on QAnon.
Oh, right.
So I think that's happening to so many people now, and people are getting anxious about, is this going to significantly sway the election? Probably not, but that that's happening, you know, that that's just a random thing that happened to someone I know that I heard about last week. I reckon there's tons of these stories coming out right now, and maybe people just aren't in the mood to treat conspiracy like fun. They're now just thinking like, what if genuinely the world's going to be further screwed because people are buying into this?
I think you're right. I think you're right in the way of conspiracy theory is like LSD or any other drug. It's fun. But if you can't handle it, you're fine.
Yeah, and you have to do it maybe with some judgment. Yeah. Yeah, with some friends who'll stop you from believing you're actually talking to God.
Yep.
Music is like a drug.
Yeah, you need to keep in touch with reality. And yeah. Right now the internet and social media is clearly something that the human race doesn't yet have the knowledge to grapple with properly, and it's resulted in a lot of people going all the way down the rabbit hole.
Generally accepted that one of these things is going to be right or have a hint of truth to it, that all based in some form of truth. And for some, it may very well be the case, but the idea in itself can be very destructive or very problematic or just misleading.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I completely get that. I completely get... See... this is what happens though when you control people's thinking.
You know, you say you can't think this?
No. I'm saying that I've written about this sort of entering into hyper reality, and this is what's happening now. We're entering into unreality. And I mean, for people to believe some of the shit that's out there.
Did you watch Hypernormalization, by the way?
No.
Oh, cool. It's the British guy who makes, I'm just looking him up.
Not Adam Curtis, is it?
It is Adam Curtis. Oh,
yes. Yeah. It's so Adam. Yeah. I really got it
a few years ago, like right around the time Trump was elected, I think maybe like a year later.
Yeah. No, totally. And I mean, if you go back to Baldrillard, for them, the Twin Towers were that marked
right.
up.
The world of the unreal.
Exactly, because it was the first time that we were living tragedy through visual imagery that we weren't there to partake in physically.
I guess Vietnam and such would be some level of that entry point to that, right? But 9/11 is a whole new thing with this sheer cinematic spectacle of the actual attacks.
Yeah, completely. And that's kind of what they talk about. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think when you enter into this sort of territory where, I think we've entered a territory where truth and fiction are redundant.
Mm.
Not that one is more valid than the other. It's actually they both have. It's redundant. Like you can't talk about things in terms of truth or fiction, truth or lies.
We have more governments than ever. Like more, or at least more governments than I can remember since I was alive everyone's always manipulating the truth and the image that they present to the world and that they present to their citizens. But right now it feels like we have a lot of nations actively fighting against the truth, trying to create a world where truth and reality don't matter.
Absolutely. I mean, just listen to fucking Trump, man. Like, look at his hyperbolic statements. He's done more for the black people than since Martin.
And believe it all, 100%.
Stephanie, get that one black guy at his rally. Let's speak.
Right.
Clearly, gone. Clearly.
Yeah. And we had, but we had Herman Cain die of COVID-19 and then have his Twitter account after he dies continue spreading like COVID-19 is a hoax stuff. Like, just the reality
why I didn't hear that
does problem. Not matter at all. Sorry, Glenn, what were you saying?
I heard that he passed away. I didn't realize about his Twitter account.
Yeah, he died of COVID because of...
Insane.
Wow.
I don't know.
But I guess I was trying to get to the point is that we're not equipped mentally to deal with... Because on one hand, you're completely right. And this is... I've written about this in the past where even Baudrillard says this, that the simulacra, the role of simulacra is to hide the fact that there never was an original and a fake.
Mm.
That there never was truth or fiction. It always was like this. We have been conditioned to believe in the idea of 100% truth.
Mm.
And so mentally, we're not equipped to deal with this territory of the hyperreal.
I think mentally, we're also just not equipped to deal with psychopathy on this level, you know, being led by completely lying psychopaths all over the world. Like, it's, you know, I mean, I'm sure it's happened many, many times before. Just the sheer bold-faced manipulation, and it's like, you must buy into these two poles, both of which are psychopathic manipulators, both of which have people like that leading them, you know, and people like to believe in someone, you know, people like to fall into one line of when there's the artificial either or thing put up, and none of the choices right now are good.
No. But one thing that's for certain too, and people don't speak about, is that our notion of, I think that there needs to be some psychological investigations into our notions of truth and how we develop notions of truth. And part of that comes from community and peers. And I mean, Adam Curtis sort of detailed this in Century of the Self, you know? And I think that's part of the problem, is that we're not understanding that exactly. I mean, if you think about, just think about COVID, how it has been presented to us from the beginning. I remember at the beginning, my partner was having arguments with people online where people are going, I'm in the medical profession and I can fucking tell you that this is nothing more than a cold. It's all been blown out of proportion.
I had someone who is now, I shit you not, doing scientific work to help find a cure for it, tell me in like February when I was reading some stuff about it and being like, this looks actually worrying. This like, if you look at these statistics, this doesn't seem good. And they're like, you know, well, it's a cold. And
I've still heard that people get the flu more every day.
Yeah, Glenn, no. This is a mutual friend of ours.
Oh,
this
okay,
person
right.
This person like in February was like, oh, you know, we just don't have immunity to it yet. Probably this many people would die of the flu every year if we didn't. And it's just, come on.
But the flu is, there's many differences here. It spreads differently. It's treatable in a different manner. And it doesn't have the impact of shutting down entire economies.
Exactly.
Yeah. But I mean, the obvious tell was like, if this was just a cold, would China have shut down Wuhan?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, it was pretty self-evident. And wasn't it?
But it was like, China's a different world. It's like no one pays attention. Go, oh, that's just China. They're just weird. Yeah. They're just doing their thing.
It matter that everyone was traveling from China around that time, and yeah, there was a potential major opportunity for spread of the virus.
Actually, you know, I read something interesting, which would be interesting / horrifying, I'm sure, to you, Stefan, as a film festival programmer, that it's theorized that the big spreading event for the US was Sundance. Because they say that a lot of people had reported a much worse than usual Sundance flu this year, with difficulty breathing and bad coughs.
Oh, Jesus. There you go.
Big international gathering right at the time when, you know, sort of just before Wuhan would be going on lockdown.
Yeah. Actually, on this, I'd love to ask you about it. So whether it's a film festival or not, like every event organized in the country right now, whether it's in a couple of weeks or a couple of months, I'm looking at having an event going in person online, have to weigh out the cost benefit, who's going to come, but also the perspective for a potential health fallout among any number of patrons. And I know this is a contentious subject, but I wonder, I know a lot of spaces are having events more and more. Certainly more pubs are opening and restaurants. A couple of festivals are having events in person coming up. Some are still having events online, or and other events in person, or are doing live streams of some events in person. And it's just that, I mean, you're a major event organizer, and you made a call to make it accessible to everyone some months out. So MIFF did the same thing. A lot of festivals are having events online in respectively in coming months to come still. And I guess my question is, the mental space all the folks in this position are in now, and the calculus is going through everyone's heads. And I'm sure that everyone is discussing amongst themselves, how do we approach this? What are we looking at in the next 2 weeks, in the next 2 months? And what's the thought processes, you think, behind everyone in this position right now?
Oh, gee. Look, some are, you know, I've spoken to some film festivals that are just staunchly, I think there's a lot of emotion involved, and people are, I mean, we wanted nothing more than to have a physical festival. It was not the responsible thing or the logical thing to do in the middle of a fucking pandemic.
These sickos physically sick.
Yeah.
Not just mentally.
Some people are staunchly holding on to the physical festival thing. You know, I got a friend in the Yukon who runs Dawson International Film Festival, and he was right, just nice. Like, I ain't going online, you know. Oh, he's the guy we stole the 48-hour film challenge from, because we had done it there and went, oh, we'll steal it from him. He's doing a drive-in. I mean, they can, because they have, like, heaps of space there, so, and their local radio stations transmitting the films and stuff, so... Mm. So they're getting around, but again, it was driven from this, like, no, we're not bowing down to it. We're going to keep our festival going, even if it means 40 people in a cinema.
Mostly the little guys won't be able to do that though. Right. Like
that's right.
Venice are just forging ahead because screw it. We can do what we want, but like they're taking a big risk.
Yeah. And
running
and
the physical. Yeah.
And they have to take specific measures, but yeah, the little guys, I don't know how the little guys would do it. Like,
It's so different for so many different spaces. I mean, you said, yeah, stuff is so intrinsic, as we discussed in previous years. It's so wonderful spilling out and being at the Factory Theatre. Other spaces, a lot of festivals like just want to go online. I was speaking to the director of the Melbourne Queer Film Festival, and he made the point that so many members of their community, those who regularly come to the screenings, are so very conscious of being autoimmune compromisation that it was such a natural thing for them to know we already go online. And whereas others are in the space where, no, we want a festival to happen. And it's a big thing, whether it's Venice and Cannes, they want it in person because that is their cachet. And so some festivals will just say, no, we'll do it next year. But others, it makes sense. Yeah, do an event online, make it accessible, have people see it. And but then we were talking to the Nashon from the Sydney Film Festival. He said, we're doing it online, but next year we're absolutely having an event in person. We don't want to have this online component. I think SUF may
no one knows though.
It's a position where we're having to go online now, but want to have the event in person next year. Like even if there is an online component, it's going to be geared towards like seeing everyone again and being in the same space.
Well, that's what I'm hoping will happen. I'm hoping that we cherry pick the best things of the online process, whether that means we have the same films. So let's say the shorts programs, because we only did shorts, the same short programs can still play at the festival, but then also be accessible online at the same time.
I mean, a big quick consideration is going to be how much content you actually have available next year, right? Like how much new stuff is actually going to be produced in the next 12 months.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yep, absolutely. And right now, this year, there was no shortage whatsoever of short films.
There might be next year.
It might be next year. Or it's just going to be all lockdown stories.
Yeah. Animation made from home.
Animation stories made in one set, low budget to mid budget stuff.
Yeah,
Very strongly COVID themed things. It could be.
It'll be great to find the next Dan Harmon, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like on that note, we did in our first year, I think we played the Adventure Time guys short before Adventure Time became big.
Oh, really? That's cool.
Yeah, it was called 2 in the AM PM.
Yeah, yeah. Awesome.
Yeah.
It's so totally stuff though. The early, like his style, even the Adventure Time pilot, honestly, could have played some of the stuff shorts programs.
Yeah, yeah. Totally. Yeah. A lot of these guys that are on Adult Swim and stuff like that, that are quite big, not that Adventure Time's on Adult Swim, but they're totally like stuff weirdos, you know, that just stuff commercial.
Have you seen his new show on Netflix where it's like he's at someone Trumbull? He's animated Pendleton Ward is his name, and he's animated some guy's podcast where it's mostly just like talking about drugs and it's weird trippy animations.
Is this Dan Harmon or
no? This is Pendleton Ward who created Adventure Time. That's his follow up to Adventure Time, a Netflix show.
Which is awesome.
An animated podcast about with this, like stoned people talking about whatever crosses their mind.
I love
it's cool. It's totally stuff in the vibe.
You know that's this is where I'm coming full circle to, you know, where things are heading. I would love to see Netflix invest more in weirdo shit like that, you know?
Yeah. But it's rare that weirdos hit the mainstream level of success that they're able to do something like that on a good budget.
You know, and it's most really, you know, in defense of Netflix, it's most really not Netflix. Like, I work with an Australian producer that I hit him up with an anthology idea. I'm like, oh, you know, like WTF or whatever is so good at our festival. Why can't we pitch an anthology to Netflix and get these guys that are just doing their shit? This would go crazy on Netflix. And he was just like, I don't see any value in it. This is stupid. It's just, it's really old dinosaur thinking.
Australia, though, is, it's such a risk-averse industry.
It's ridiculous.
It's a dead industry. It's not an industry because there's no risk-taking.
You hit the nail on the head, man. And hate to say this, but, you know, I will blanket. Like, this is like 99% of producers in this country. Maybe 99.9. Let's just include everyone. 100% of producers in this country are fucking risk adverse. Like, which means they have no career. Like, they're dead in the water. Like,
when you are hungry and desperate, as Australian filmmakers are, you have to take risks.
Yeah, it's the only way. Yeah,
you have to be noticed.
This is the problem. They're not hungry. They're not hungry and desperate. They pretend, they cry like they're hungry and desperate. We're really, they're fucking sitting comfortably on the stupid drama dollar of Screen Australia.
Yeah. Look, if I to cross more lines, Film Fight Club shouldn't cross.
Are there lines? Are there really?
Are there any lines? We spoke a fair bit recently about the honestly goddamn stupid. Actually, this reminds me of something else related to our conspiracy talk just before. But we spoke recently on the show a bit about the stupid controversy about mukbang.
What mukbang?
There was a short that Eliza Scanlon made, which for various reasons people found offensive, and the family law tried to cancel, or Michelle Law, tried to cancel the person who made it on Twitter, and then it became a culture war that Andrew Bolt got involved about, look at how dumb the left is. He was kind of right.
I hate agreeing with Bolt. The problem with Bolt's column that it wasn't evident from his column, and in fairness, also from Michelle Law's commentary that
they actually watched
the film. If you've seen the film, say so and make it evident what your actual issue with it is.
People we spoke to who are like hardcore social justice warriors who saw the film said it is not offensive. Or like it kind of is, but like not, it's not worth, like, to such a small extent that it was not worth the controversy.
Yeah.
A point that one of these people made to me when we were talking about it was that the real controversy should have been that Eliza Scanlon won the Short Film Award, because they were saying it was like here's a look, it could be the best short film. I haven't seen all the shorts or any of the shorts really, beyond on some clips of mukbang. But I would say broadly, isn't the point of a short film award to get up and comers to be noticed?
Yeah.
Like, they got a actor who's in Hollywood productions who is already having the narrative written around, like leading in a big new film that was going to have a Sydney Film Festival premiere. And, you know, we have a jury of like George Miller and Brian Brown and stuff, and they chose to select her to win. Even if the film's the best, it gets into the political thing where it's like, no, give someone the leg up.
Totally, yeah. No, but that's, yeah. This is, welcome to the Australian industry.
yeah. I just thought that encapsulates the problems with it. It's like, it's the in crowd that will only select the in crowd, and everyone's comfortable. And
yeah, but this is one of the good things I think that will come out of it. Like if the Australian film industry wasn't dead before, it will be dead after COVID, and it needs to die. Rebirth.
Hopefully there's desire for a rebirth.
Yeah. Cause those old dinosaurs, like, you know, as much as I love Brian Brown and stuff, like, God, just look at fucking Palm Beach, man. Like,
yeah.
Yes. I love Ice House, but make a film about those types of bands. But I mean, to qualify Chris's earlier point, and this actually just also underlines how frustrating the state of the industry is.
It's not a shot at Eliza Scanlon, George Miller, or Brian Brown, for the record. I like all three of them. No.
Except Palm Beach.
Yeah, except for Palm Beach.
I never made this connection, but Eliza Scanlon, she didn't win the Best Short Film Award. She won the Best Director Award. The Best Short Film Award winner, who got no...
Right, she won Best Director,
and
though.
Still,
it's the personal, like, and here you are...
And who I'd never actually, I didn't really look at the coverage because there wasn't really any coverage of the best film winner. The best film winner is actually a lady I work with. And we were at, I didn't know about this. She hadn't raised it at work. I was at Knox Bar this weekend for one of the Read to Me sessions, and she did a presentation. And it would have been amazing if this filmmaker, who doesn't have near the traction of Eliza Scanlon, who actually won the major award, had gotten the publicity. But no, it got caught up in... And Eliza Scanlon winning an award, she deserved it, fine. I would be able to judge it had I had the opportunity to see it, but they didn't allow folks to see the movie. We did reach out, but the fact that this controversy got swept up and where it should have been, no, this up-and-coming filmmaker won the major award. Why wasn't this more talked about? Why wasn't this more focused in the industry? And why wasn't this more the focus of Sydney film festivals and others' plaudits and publicity? Hey,
yeah,
a new emerging filmmaker won a major award. This is what we should be talking about.
I agree. Yeah.
You know, on just a completely irrelevant tangent that got sparked when I was talking about the mukbang controversy, did you guys hear about the current ongoing thing about Cuties on Netflix?
I haven't seen
Cuties
controversy, and I've seen the poster.
The poster was a really dumb move by Netflix. What I've heard is, that people who generally haven't seen the film, which I've heard is not offensive, at least not on the level that people are blowing this up into. It's this pedophile panic thing about this French movie, which is about, it's about an African immigrant who ends up in a twerking group of kids, right? And competing in dance competitions and stuff. And people have blown it into a thing about Netflix is making a pedophile film and they're getting senators to write into Netflix. And it's gotten way, way, way out of hand.
I wonder how many have actually watched the movie is the thing. I haven't seen very, this, I can't comment, but you got
to
see it.
I've heard from people who seem to be rational about this that it's not offensive or it is not a pedophile film. But we had that, and we also had the controversy over with MIF, The Trouble with Being Born, which Virat Nehru saw, and he's left us now, listeners, by the way. If you're wondering about his absence from this chat, he had to go. But he saw, and he personally didn't find it to be offensive either. I'm just wondering now if that conspiracy QAnon thing, where there's so much moral panic about pedophilia right now that people are seeing it in places where it isn't really there. If we've reached the point now where you just cannot address the subject of sexualization of children or sexuality, blossoming sexuality or anything like that, without people accusing you of being a pedophile. You can't do that in a non-pedophilic way. That subject is just 100% gone off the table. If you have a movie that features kids dancing, Netflix won't buy the rights to it. I just feel the conspiracy thing has reached the point where it's affecting culture in ways that aren't fun, you know?
It's a double-edged sword there, because Disney's been sort of subtextually pedophilic for a long time.
True, yeah.
So
that's the thing.
But they allow Disney stuff, yeah.
Right. Yeah, because when people raise points about unhealthy objectification of children, they do have a point. It's just, though, where it becomes a witch hunt, which is what it's become, I think.
I think polemicizing anything, you know, is not healthy, because it shuts down discussion. It's and we were bound to hit another era of this sort of polemicizing. But you know, usually this sort of polemicist stuff happens around wartime.
Mm.
If you think about Vietnam War and stuff, there was a lot of really strong, the 70s, 60s were really strong sort of polemic times.
Yeah. A friend of mine, when I was talking about 18 months ago, I was talking to a friend who's now experiencing the real COVID life in Melbourne, about the state of the world, and how it, seemed to be no hope, no future, and what the hell's going on. And he said, yeah, but maybe this is just what it feels like to live through the 1960s.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised. You know, one of my conspiracy theories is that we're definitely heading to a hot war at some point. Everything's pointing to that.
It does seem that way, doesn't it?
Yeah.
We've had some pretty serious skirmishes, confrontations over a lot of borders, which have gone underreported.
Yeah.
Right.
A lot of bold acts from the major powers recently.
Is that between China and...
China and India.
Yeah.
But you throw in climate change into the mix. God damn. If you talk about scarcity of food and regions becoming uninhabitable. There's no, with the level of tension we have now, and that happening, I can't see any way we don't have a hot war.
No, totally true. And if that kind of happens, Australia's in a bizarre position too, because we're allied with the US and but very close to China. And, you know,
that's why I don't understand why Scott Morrison is running with the path he's taking, honestly. Like, I think,
you mean the anti-China?
Yeah, I think it makes, I wonder if there's anything more to it than America's going anti-China, let's fall in line with that, because it doesn't seem strategically smart to me in the long term. I would be hedging my bets. We are a small country, close to China, you know?
Oh, but look, the reality is when you break power down into its simplest form, there's nothing else that can happen, because we're Commonwealth, you know, we're like, what are we to do? You know what I mean? Like, there's just politically no way our power goes back to the Commonwealth. So
yeah,
you can't kind of, unless we secede or something, you know, which,
yeah, which is fine. Like, by which point we have our own head of state. Like, that's just okay, guys. We can make, it's not a priority for me, but we can make that happen.
Yeah, I think Western Australia and Queensland are heading that in. Yeah,
yeah. I want to see us as a republic before I see Queensland and WA. And we make jokes about Queensland and WA, but, you know, we're Australia. We like them. Real part of one. So we've talked a lot about SUF. For those who are going online and joining us, watching all the shorts and Take 48, how do we get there? How do we find it?
So you just go to suff.com.au, and it's just so easy. You can just go on there, buy tickets. It takes you straight to the page. And we're on till the 20th. So yeah, go on and get your alcohol and your chips and sugar.
It's the way to, yeah, do what we did.
Recommend
a bunch of friends over, well, too many, as long as you're social distance, and get some snacks and some beers, and just get the program pass, and just watch a bunch of shorts, mix it up a little, watch them Take 48, watch them Love Sick, and it's pretty fun. Like, our late night, early morning sesh, it's what SUF is all about. I remember the pyjama parties were so much fun. We basically had that.
You can have your own pyjama party.
Exactly. You can have your own pyjama party. And then we'll all do it again probably next year in the basement, in the bowels of the Factory Theatre.
Absolutely.
Yeah, man.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
And thanks for going online and putting it together. It's nice to have SUF again. It's a bit of normalcy against a very abnormal time. Yes. It's a bit of abnormal normalcy in a very abnormal time.
Absolutely. Well, look, you guys stay safe, hey?
Yeah, you too, man.
All right. See you later.
All the best.
Welcome back to Film Fight Club, where we are talking all things Bill and Ted Face the Music, the newest time travel themed film in cinemas. There are many.
The newest in a very long, at this point, chain in movies about alternate timelines, perhaps designed as a answer to the realization that we're in one of the worst possible timelines. But don't let my cynicism stop you. Here's Bill and Ted to put a smile on your face with an optimistic take on the future.
Yeah, perfect timing with a film they've been calling for the better part of two decades. There's been a bit of a cult move to make this happen. It has happened. It's here. It stars Alex Winter, who was always credited first in the Bill and Ted movies.
Not in number two. I watched it the other day. Keanu had usurped him by that point.
Oh, damn it.
Number one, he was credited first.
I like that there was a time where Alex Winter was a bigger star than Keanu Reeves.
Might I get the ball rolling on our thoughts on this film by saying perhaps he should be?
Yeah, he's good in this.
We'll get to that. I should let you introduce.
Yeah, just what the film.
This most excellent journey.
This most excellent journey, dude.
Time and space. Totally non-bogus, Ted.
Hey, dude.
Anyway,
we were just going to do our best non-Jody Utah impressions. Yeah, yeah, this is just a continuation of the Bill and Ted franchise from the late 80s and early 90s. It stars Keanu Reeves and Alex Winter, but also Samara Weaving and Christian Schnall and quite a few others in returning stars.
They play the daughters of Bill and Ted.
And of the historical babes. I rewatched the other two recently, so they're still relatively fresh in my mind.
Yeah, so basically Bill and Ted are washed up, right?
Yeah, they're washed up stars. They're not the glorious wild stallions with a Y that they were.
And it's, how come we haven't changed the future? How come we haven't written a song that will unite all of humanity like we were supposed to? So Bill and Ted confront the disappointments of middle age and the horrors of aging.
They don't look too bad for guys in their late 50s.
They don't.
It's more like a 3/4 life crisis, because I won't even call it a midlife crisis. It's more than a midlife crisis. It's past that. Like a
Keanu Reeves will live forever, man.
Yeah, it's, by his standards, it's definitely a midlife.
He lives an awesome lifestyle.
Broadly, what did we all think of this?
Well, I think Virat should start, because I think for reasons we were chatting over Aaron will become apparent.
I actually enjoyed this film, and hang on, before you guys be like, "Ah, how could you?" Yes, this
you're allowed to like it.
Absolutely,
it's okay to like a movie. Where it's okay to tell you why you're wrong. No, you're not wrong.
Okay. I agree this movie makes no sense, and the previous two actually had very good logical reasons why things happened. This movie, on the other hand, has none of that. This is completely nonsensical. But I felt, given the time that it came out, this is more a timing issue. And I think this is the right movie for our times, where almost nothing makes sense, and it is kind of slapstick, but not really. It is so tongue-in-cheek that you can't differentiate irony from when it is trying to be tongue-in-cheek and when it's actually just being completely nonsensical.
Well, okay. The original Bill and Ted movies had a approach which is arguably one of the better ways to make a comedy on film, which is not necessarily trying to make you laugh all the time with jokes, but just striking a consistently funny or weird tone. You know, the general gist of it is always funny, even though it is not always trying to make you laugh.
And we have to make a distinction between the stoner movies of the 80s and 90s and their irreverence versus just the nonsensicality and irreverence that a lot of films try to do now to imitate the likes of Dude, Where's My Car? And this. On the other two, I really liked the first two Bill and Ted films. The first one, less so, was original. The second one was incredibly visually creative, great parody.
Yeah,
this is just coasting on the appeal of the other two.
Yeah, I would say 100% that this, though, fits the mold of that classic stoner movie as opposed to something like Anchorman. It's not the more modern type of comedy. This is sort of coasting on the vibe and not going really out of its way all the time. In some ways, this does feel successful in what they were attempting to do, in that it is that strange coasting on a vibe. There was a moment midway through where I leant over and whispered, you know, like, this is really weird. Like, it does feel strange in the way that the Bill and Ted movies did, but only to a point when you realize how familiar it is. You were very right, Glenn, to point out how incredibly creative the second one is. I love Bill and Ted 2.
It's a great, very underrated film. The Bergman parodies, yeah. The battleship scene, still the best iteration of the death symbol in comedy.
Bill and Ted 2 is like Gremlins 2 or something. It's like that era of sequels where they just go, we're not interested in rehashing the original. People will go and see it. Let's go wild, right? Throw out a ton of ideas. Bill and Ted 2 is shockingly creative, visually as well as conceptually. The time travel hijinks in the climax of Bill and Ted 2 are some of the best I've ever seen in any film.
And for all you Rick and Morty fans who love some of the visual creativity in some of the dream episodes, that is...
Guess what? Bill and Ted did it first.
It's actually a parody of Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. They were creative. This one, there were individual scenes I really liked. I'd point to the scene that's widely used in the trailer where they're going to the future and they're buff prison versions of themselves. There's one that's not in the trailer where they're very British, which is very funny. And I liked a couple of...
Weird.
Where the orders go funny. Back in time. But those were like, I can count the scenes I liked on one hand.
I was enjoying it for the first 20, 25 minutes. Okay, I think the thing that all revivals have to answer is, why do a revival? I would definitely ask this question of Bill and Ted 2, because the ending of Bill and...
The people wanted it. The people want this.
That's not good enough. Arrested Development shouldn't have come back as a big example. Okay. Most things shouldn't come back. Right. It's whether or not people want them. Good. The role of the artist is not necessarily to give people what they want or are asking for, but what they don't know they want. I think Bill and Ted 3 Revival could have worked. I even think it could have worked with this concept, but not quite like this.
It's not as much of a cash grab as people think it is. I still think this had enough of originality and trying to at least do something different, even though it didn't succeed most of the time. It didn't entirely feel like it is trying to just coast on the first two films and their success.
For me, I don't think it's a cash grab.
I don't think that's it.
It's a nostalgia tour, which is what most revivals are.
It's what the guys in it wanted to make one of these for ages. Keanu Reeves obviously wanted to have a good time. Alex Wint has been pushing this for years and years, and it actually shows in the film. Reeves is enjoying it, but Winter is so goddamn happy to be headlining this film. It shows in his performance. He's having time. Every scene, he's invested. He's loving it. His charisma is contagious in it, I think a little more than Reeves, to be honest.
Completely. The big takeaway of this for me was more movies with Alex Wint, please. When you were talking about that prison guard sequence, that just reminded me of how when you see the big scary, mean, pumped up, jacked Bill and Ted. Alex Wint is Bill, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Bill is actually convincing and funny in that role. And Ted is like, oh, look, it's Keanu Reeves in a suit. He is in the mode he's been in a lot of recent Keanu Reeves films, not John Wick, where he just can't bring enough intensity. And look, I love Keanu Reeves, but he's just not acting very well. But he's totally getting showed up by his daughter doing an impression of him.
Yeah, Samara Weaving.
Wasn't it Samara Weaving playing Bill's daughter?
Their scenes were fun.
She was playing Bill's daughter.
One particularly interesting rendition of an historical figure and another, which was quite good.
Mm. But Alex Winter carried the entire movie. He was funny. He was emoting, which Keanu Reeves is sort of half doing. Alex Winter's great. It just makes you sad that he never had much of a career. I feel like he should start getting cast and stuff all the time now. He's great.
He does a lot of non-film things, and he's great. Right. I liked him in this a lot. And he also does a lot of films that haven't got as much attention as Keanu Reeves' work over the past, 30 years.
Maybe the best thing that's come out of this is that Alex Winter might still headline stuff.
I hope.
Actually, Alex Winter's revival and not Bill and Ted as a franchise.
Going back to what I was saying before about why do a revival, right? The ending of Bill and Ted 2 basically
tied everything up,
right? In order to have Bill and...
There's no world building in this, really.
Yeah. In order for Bill and Ted 3 to work, it essentially begins with a massive retcon, right? Like the way that we've defined how Bill and Ted's level of success and the place they're at now is really a retcon on what we were told. I know that these movies aren't meant to be taken seriously, so you could say this whole thing is just nitpicking, but if you're a fan of the original movies, you basically have to be able to buy into this, right? So for the first 20 or 30 minutes, I wasn't thinking about this because I was just enjoying the weirdness of bringing back Bill and Ted. Yeah, and it's funny seeing these establishing scenes of middle-aged Bill and Ted talking about partying on and going against society's expectations.
Yeah, but Keanu Reeves looks like he knows this is a bit of a joke. Alex Wood is properly in it.
He's committed. But he's carrying the movie.
Do the guitar.
Yeah, but doing Bill and Ted...
The cultural moment has passed a bit. It has to be a little more reflective of the time.
I think they've attempted to do that by making this movie about how Bill and Ted are washed up and things haven't worked out for them and things weren't as they, you know.
Yeah.
Because the answer is the weirdness of having Bill and Ted out of time, of just transporting them at basically as they were to the current, you know. But I was just thinking with Bill and Ted's level of success at the second one, what does being a washed up star actually look like? In this, it's basically as though Bill and Ted never achieved any level of success.
Yeah.
Right? Like if they were as popular as they did, where they played a mega concert at the Grand Canyon, even if they put out crap material for the last 30 years, it would be like, oh, it wouldn't be like, your daughters are still living at home at 24 and writing music and not having jobs. It would be like, yeah, they can keep doing that. They can keep doing that while we cash the royalties. They'll figure it out eventually. Yeah, it's all cool. Like Bill and Ted would live in the Dave Grohl mansion we see later in the film.
Which was pretty very funny.
That's what it should have been. It should have been like, we're coasting or we've given up or we've split up and we've got to get back together or something. Because like these guys were like U2 level big. They were bigger. They were bigger than the Beatles probably. They were like at least Rolling Stone level big, right?
Well, to use the Beatles analogy or the comment, they're bigger than Jesus, that really applied to the level of fame they wanted to impart. So
there's no way they would just
relate to this universe. No, but they, but well, we always have the story of the semi washed up rock star. It's very neatly into that mold. And that's the thing. The first two Bill and Ted films, even though they were stoner films, they were against different genre norms. This doesn't do that. It just falls into that.
They could be the washed up, like, oh, it's a shame the state they're in, but they wouldn't be playing open mic. They just wouldn't be playing music at all. And the concept would have been Bill and Ted have to learn to play music together, because it turns out that massive hit single they thought was the song wasn't, because the people from the future come back and like, what are you doing? The problem is, I won't get into all of my fan fiction ideas about what Bill and Ted 3 should have been, but honestly, there was...
It's a liftoff for a potential spinoff with the daughters.
I think that's part of what they were going for. But then,
so a film should never be a spinoff for another.
They're not
never
fully
be designed as such.
Yeah, they're not. Tell that to Marvel Studios.
I will, and I have, Chris. Yeah. Hope you're listening, Marvel.
Yeah, take that, Disney. It's just that, as you said, you see the potential for other better films. There's so many other better directions they could have taken it in. I think if they were going to really confront the weirdness of having Bill and Ted back, I would be okay with them doing something light if it was as boundary pushing and creative as Bill and Ted 2 was. But
better film, for the record, it is the best of the series.
Dude, Bill and Ted 2, like I was saying, it's amazingly creative. This film is missing the obvious opportunities suggested by its setup. Bill and Ted 2, on the other hand, surprises you. In this one, I think they needed to go darker.
Right by the books, actually. Like, this narrative is, it's trying to be weird, but actually...
It's actually kind of by the books.
Like hitting the beats and be like, oh, cool, now this happens, now this happens, now this happens.
Yeah, so... Yeah,
they had ideas. It's like an episode of SNL. And not that I don't like SNL, I enjoy it a lot. They had a bunch of ideas for individual sketches involving Bill and Ted. Some are funny, some are not. They're very poorly strung together. And that's nothing like the original two films were, where it was a narrative where they had a goal. They were trying to get all the historical figures. They were trying to impress their partners and achieve glory. There's a lot more of a clear motivating arc in those. Whereas here it's, oh, wouldn't it be funny if they were doing this and this? And some of it's great to see them in costume and get up, but a lot of it doesn't land. I refer to the scenes that worked really well.
But the biggest problem of it for me is that it's a greatest hits package of Bill and Ted 1 and 2. So it's the Bill and Ted 1 stuff of, we're going to go back and collect a bunch of historical figures. Side note, that ends up being totally irrelevant to the thread of the narrative. The way that the narrative resolves itself is actually a cop-out, I would say. And it's just not that well thought out a story. Yeah, but
completely for a spinoff.
Yeah, it's that aspect of Bill and Ted 1 combined with the we're going to go to hell and meet death stuff from Bill and Ted 2.
But the daughters were, the actresses for the daughters were funny.
There is some new stuff in there, but in general, for me, it felt too much like a rehash and a greatest hits package. And the problem is that when you invite comparisons like that, you can't fall short. The direction...
When number 2 went so far off the beaten track.
Exactly. The direction in this new one is quite bad, like quite flat visually. I can accept that it's low budget, bad CGI. What I can't accept is the absence of great ideas. If you look at the way that Hell
was... a much bigger budget on this one than any of the others.
Oh, I doubt it. I reckon relative for its time, Bill and Ted 2 was a much more expensive movie. I mean, the sets and stuff in Bill and Ted 2 are still great. And the puppet and stuff, Bill and Ted 2 looks like they spent some money on it.
But the CGI in this, they could have spent a little money on a script and else.
Meh. I'm not here to take them to task for having a low budget. That's fine. But just think about how much more creative and also less expensive to produce the conceptualization of Hell is in Bill and Ted 2 versus 3. 3, it looks like generic concept art of, you know, hell with demons flying around and big plains of lava, and you've seen it a million times before. Bill and Ted 2 looked for a creative way around illustrating what hell would be like. It just shows the difference between the movies. They needed to come back with that level of creativity to justify themselves. And if not that, I think they've tried to make a film that won't sit too strangely on the shelf next to Bill and Ted 1 and 2. But I think that's a fool's errand, because it's always going to be weird when you've got these really middle-aged guys. It's always going to be out of time and strange. I think if they were going to do it, they needed to really address that. I think they've tried to do it lightly, but I think the movie, if it's going to deal with themes about aging and family, I think and disappointment.
This doesn't feel like a trilogy in the slightest.
Yeah, and family being potentially falling apart. It's touching on those themes. I know that Bill and Ted is dumb stoner fun, but I think they needed to address that deeper to justify the film's existence and make something more heartfelt. And I can think of a bunch of ways they could have done that, but they dropped the ball.
I have a theory about that, about the weirdest weirder thing and whether or not this film could be weirder. The problem with that is maybe our generation probably was spoiled for choice when it comes to like stoner films and weirder films.
You are.
When you're appealing to the next generation, I think the problem is I don't think anybody's quite as sure as to how much weird is too weird or whether or not there is acceptance of that weird genre anymore, given the fact that we are now in a different time. So they try to go for that, but still try to play it safe as well. Trying to see like, oh, maybe this is too weird now. It wouldn't be weird in the 90s, but maybe now the times have changed. And what was weird and cool back then could just be weird and creepy.
They changed it. It was. And now what I'm with isn't it. This isn't a film that is made for our parents' generation only. It's made for us. It's made to be generally acceptable and a similar camera of what we understand a stoner comedy is or once was. It's supposed to be, you recognize this. This is your Bill and Ted. Like, this was your Star Wars. And it's not our Star Wars. It's a different thing entirely.
It's a nostalgia trip. It doesn't
sit comfortably within the Bill and Ted within the Bill and Ted arc. There isn't any reason as such. If the film had properly addressed today, our feelings, as many stoner good stoner comedies would, disenfranchisement, of feeling a little alienated for what is going on generally in society, and for a lot of people's sense of hopelessness or helplessness, it would be great. But it didn't really do that.
They're afraid to really go there.
Of, hey, we are washed up. It just kind of started this shooting point and then went off into Bill and Ted's greatest hits.
Yeah, I just think that the idea of, like I said before, going back to what they did, I sort of just ask why. Because, yeah, you're retconning the way that Bill and Ted 2 ended. So it's not going to be that, wow, it's so great to see them on the big screen. Like, hardcore fans could be annoyed by that. It's funny to talk about the idea of hardcore fans of Bill and Ted.
There are plenty.
I know there are plenty. And on the other hand, you know, you're not going to hit the same appeal of, like, this is just a silly, fun romp. Because young people aren't going to watch this, if they have no familiarity, they're probably not going to watch this because it screams boomer movie, right? Gen X movie. I know it's not really boomer. It's anchored by these two old stars and it's all built around nostalgia. I sort of feel like it's the like trying to please everyone, try to please no one thing. Like, I think you needed to address the weirdness Glenn was talking about like coming back to this time and doing it now and confronting these ideas of disappointment. And you can do that and still make a silly, fun movie. It doesn't have to be a really dark, heavy thing. It's Bill and Ted. I just think they could have more elegantly built the movie around the themes, and the climax should have been heartfelt and was not. The climax was actually really dumb, by the way. The climax was the worst part of the movie.
And the film, other films, they weren't dumb. They were silly, but they weren't dumb. There's an important distinction.
Yes.
This was just pure uninteresting irreverence.
I was just thinking, because the thing is, with the problem with the film is, essentially, what they're trying to do as well is they're trying to introduce Gen X, or the latest generation, whichever gen now it is, to
Gen Bill Z. Ted.
No
Gen
one's quite clear.
To basically the stoner movie genre, because I feel this current generation doesn't have that. But they want to do it in a way which is still safe enough so it doesn't alienate them entirely, you know, so that they don't watch the movie and be like, this is weird as fuck, bro. And like, you know, I don't want to be watching this.
But yeah, I think like trying to get people, like trying to make this movie appeal to the young generation is something they shouldn't go out of their way to do. I think it should have just sat as it was, what it was. No.
The problem is, I think in a lot of people's minds, that stoner generation is a demographic, and that's like
Gen X, the stoner generation. I love it.
Pretty much, like, you know, and people feel like, you know, once you pass that age, you're kind of like beyond that kind of zeitgeist.
Well, that's what the movie's about.
Thanks for listening. This has been Glenn Fowings and Chris Evans of Arat Nehru. The Sydney Underground Film Festival is screening now. Bill and Ted Face the Music is in cinemas. And check out Queer Screen and the other festivals that are happening online. Have a wonderful night. Enjoy movies. Stay chill, dudes. Good night.